Welcome to Ring of Fire. I'm Farron Cousins. Coming up on today's show, Heather Digby Parton from Salon.com is going to be here to talk with us both about the attack on Paul Pelosi and what we can expect from next week's midterms. That's right. We're just a couple days away from the end of voting, and there's a lot of surprises that could happen and a lot of disappointments. We're going to talk about all of that with Digby in just a few moments. We also have Donald Trump now suing New York Attorney General Letitia James because he claims that James has been harassing his company, and it's totally unfair because they did nothing wrong. The facts tell us otherwise. Elon Musk is now the owner of Twitter for the past week, and it could not have been a worse week for the Tesla and SpaceX and, of course, now Twitter CEO. We'll have all the details about Elon's very bad week coming up. And Kash Patel, the Trump aide who was actually his liaison to the National Archives, has now been given an immunity deal to testify against Donald Trump by the DOJ. More on that coming up, along with several other stories. And if you want the full show every week, go subscribe and become a member at rofpodcast.com. And don't forget, you can get Ring of Fire every day of the week on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/TheRingOfFire. Half the country was shocked this past week when an attacker broke into Nancy Pelosi's home and attacked her husband with a hammer, resulting in him having to have emergency surgery. As of right now, still in the hospital, recovering. But I say half the country was shocked because it seemed like from the response, Republicans didn't seem to care all that much. Joining me now to talk about this, as well as a discussion about the midterms next week, Heather Digby Parton from Salon.com. And Heather, an atrocious attack. A MAGA freak did this. We know that. But as disturbing as the attack was, I think a lot of the response we have seen from Republicans, you know, all the way up into the upper echelons of their leadership in Congress, that's been as equally disgusting. You know, what has emerged this past week, the things they do, the jokes they make. This is beyond disturbing, isn't it?
Beyond disturbing. It's actually kind of terrifying, to tell you the truth, because what we've been seeing, and this has been coming on slowly, and now it seems to be accelerating, the idea of violence sort of backing up their political position. I mean, you saw January 6th, of course, was the big red flag. You know, this is where these people are going. And now we're seeing this sort of thing, right? I mean, this was, you know, it wasn't technically an assassination attempt, but certainly it was assassination intent. That's what that man went in there to do, was to hurt. I guess he said he didn't want to kill her. He just wanted to, you know, break her kneecaps to show others what could be done to them if they didn't, you know, quote, stop lying, which he was very unspecific about what that was. The whole thing is an absolute nightmare, breaking in, attacking family members. And the reaction that we saw was absolutely despicable and kind of, to be honest with you, it surprised even me. I mean, you and I follow this really closely. We can't, it's our jobs, we have to do that. And, you know, we know what they're capable of, generally speaking. But I have to admit that I was taken aback by the callousness with which this thing was greeted. I mean, even to the extent of saying, you know, some of them, like, you know, Mitch McConnell, I think he called the attack disgusting, and you know, there were some thoughts and prayers and people saying, you know, this was, there's no place for violence, you know, in the world, et cetera, et cetera. The refusing to, you know, confront what actually happened, even in, and especially in the days since the information was released about the man's motive. It's clear, as you say, this was a MAGA attack. This was somebody who had gone deep into the MAGA rabbit hole, which is being promoted by Donald Trump on his social media. He's promoting it every day, all this fever swamp stuff, including QAnon. And, you know, he's putting where we go one, we go all. He's sending out these memes. He's retweeting them. He's obviously encouraging them. And nobody could say anything about that. Nobody could say, look, everyone needs to turn down the temperature. Well, there's only one party that's benefiting from this high temperature right now. The Democrats aren't benefiting from this. They're getting nothing out of this. This is totally a Republican thing where this demonization of the other side, this is really bad. I mean, this is really bad. And the fact that they can't say anything about it is a nightmare. And I don't know where it's going to end up.
Well, and it's very interesting, too, the way they immediately, the Republicans, started pushing out all these conspiracy theories. You know, this man was somehow a male prostitute that was hired by the 82-year-old Paul Pelosi, and then they got into a fight, and that's why he got beat. They tried to say, God, that, oh, no, he's actually a super liberal. He's got Black Lives Matter flags on the van that he's living in, and he's got the Pride flag up there, so this was definitely not a right-winger. That's what came out in the early days. And then, of course, the police officers finally released the conversations where he said, I wanted to get Nancy Pelosi because she was, quote, the leader of the pack of Democrats. So it was very clear. Then, of course, his former employer, the guy that hired him, he was a carpenter, so he, you know, hired him as a carpenter's assistant, I guess, said, no, this guy got deep down the rabbit hole. Like, he was totally normal at first, but then once he got online, started following this stuff, got into Pizzagate, got into the Q stuff, as you said, and he became radicalized by this information. And I think the most terrifying part of this is not just, okay, that the guy got radicalized, but that it happened so quickly. I mean, this was just a matter of, you know, about 2 years of this guy being online, being fed this garbage, 2 years from being a normal guy to I'm breaking into the Speaker of the House's home. That is what is just so shocking, because we've seen what they can do, and now we're seeing that it's not just relegated to the Capitol on January 6th. They'll go to your home. Yeah. That's scary to me, especially doing what we do. We get threats, obviously, not as many as, you know, Pelosi, but by God, if they can get in there, none of us are safe. None of us.
Well, you're absolutely right. And look, just look back to last year when they were all descending on those school boards. Do you remember? Yeah. Also based upon, you know, rabbit hole conspiracy theories. And they were saying to the school board members as they came out, there was this footage, I think it was in Virginia, where the school board members were coming out of the meeting. And they were saying, we know who you are. We know who you are. We know where you live. You know, that kind of threat. It's happening all over the country to election workers, healthcare workers over the pandemic and, you know, that all of that. It's happening to, you know, local politicians. It's happening to school board members. It's happening to teachers and administrators. Like I said, it's this threat of menace that's hanging over everything, the entire culture. And it's not coming from the left. You know, and I would just make one point, too. The radicalization. I think it's really important what you just said, that this has happened so quickly and that it's just, you know, this just full descent into the rabbit hole. This isn't it isn't very gradual. You know, it's not like somebody's been going to meetings and kind of hearing things and whatever. I would just sort of draw a correlation there between what we maybe 5 or 6 years ago, when there were all these terrorist threats that were happening in the United States. Remember the lone wolves? Those people that, you know, the Pulse nightclub, for instance, you know, down in Florida, or any number of other attacks, San Bernardino here in California, where I am. These were people who did the same thing. They were radicalized online by, you know, Islamic extremists, and they went out and committed terrorist acts and killed people. And, you know, at that time, the right wing was all for pulling out every stop to stop it. They were ready to shut down the internet, do whatever you needed to do to make sure that people were safe from that. And, you know, it was terrifying. I mean, it was that there was some guy in his basement watching these things on YouTube or whatever, and suddenly they go out and decide to commit violence. People had no trouble seeing the relationship between that radicalization, that kind of propaganda that they were consuming, and the act that they committed. But for some reason, the right wing in this country is unable to see the correlation of the same exact thing that these people are doing. They are spending their time online. They are watching. I mean, I hate to say it, but we've got mainstream news, you know, news networks that are purveying, you know, not quite as overtly as QAnon, but it's all out there, right? They've got the great replacement theory and all this other stuff on Fox News. And this is, you know, this is the same kind of threat, only this time it's homegrown. This time it's people in our own neighborhoods. And this time it's people who are directly targeting political figures and you know, government entities and employees. I mean, it's to me, you know, this is pretty terrifying. And yet we're kind of being told, well, you can't really say that, you know, it's our fellow American. It's not really nice, whatever. I'm sorry. I think we have to say it. I think we have to say that they are being indoctrinated the same way that Islamic fundamentalist terrorists were being indoctrinated. I see very little difference.
Oh, absolutely. And it is interesting. Obviously, Biden gave a speech this week, but it's not that speech that sticks out to me. It's the speech he gave about a month or two ago, where he talked about the threat that these mm-hmm. MAGA people posed. And that's, you know, when he came up with the ultra MAGA now. Mm-hmm. And he took obviously a lot of heat from that from the right. How dare you, you know, say that we're all these extremists. He's been 100% vindicated. And you and I knew that, obviously, that yes, he's accurate with this. But I think it's worth re-upping for everybody that speech. I mean, you know, go back and watch it again in the context of what's happened in the last week. And it's amazing how prescient President Biden was right there. Like he knew it. They know the threats. They warned us, and the Republicans laughed it off and got mad and used it in their campaigns. And he was right. He was absolutely dead on right about how dangerous these people are.
Yeah. And, you know, and the fact and what's most terrifying is what we first started off with, which is, it's one thing to have some, you know, the lone wolf go out and commit something, and that's terrible, and we should do everything we can to prevent that sort of thing. But basically, it's being condoned by the Republican Party, or at least large, you know, very important parts of the Republican Party, and it sure as hell is not being roundly condemned. I mean, what you see is it's sort of a, you know, a pro forma condemnation of violence on all sides. An awful lot of people saying, well, it's both sides. And yeah, of course, there are nuts on both sides. You know, I mean, that goes without saying. But there is only one party that has a full-fledged institutional kind of support system for those nuts. It's not the Democrats. The Democrats come out. I mean, there was that awful thing that happened to the softball game in Washington with Steve Scalise, which they've been mentioning all the time. And, you know, and that's legitimate. I mean, that was a political act of violence. I mean, it there's no doubt about it. But what to have Nancy Pelosi and Bernie Sanders, who the guy had apparently volunteered for at some point in his one of his campaigns, they both came down and roundly condemned the not just violence and both sides of that. They condemned the person and said, this is a terrible thing. This guy is completely out of control. All of his beliefs are wrong. I reject them. This is absolutely not the way we do business. They made it very clear that they were not endorsing this behavior. They were condemning it. That is not happening on the Republican side. It really isn't from anybody, least of all Donald Trump, who is the head of the, you know, he's the undisputed head of the Republican Party and probably, you know, 99% certain going to be the nominee for president in 2024. He didn't say anything for days. And when he finally came out and said it, he said, well, it's sad, but, you know, there's a lot of questions about this. I mean, there's a lot of questions. And did the glass, was it broken outwards or broken inwards? And what scared me about that was, what this means is that Donald Trump, the head of the Republican Party, who, you know, I mean, we all know that he really has nothing to do, right? I mean, he's not running. He's basically, you know, chatting on the phone, doing what he always does. He's going down that rabbit hole. He knew about some very, very weird, you know, parts of the rumors and the fever swamp kind of, you know, conspiracy theory. Donald Trump knew about this. He knew the details, right? That tells me that this guy is going into, now, I don't think he's online personally. He's just hanging around with people who are. And this is what he's hearing. This is what he's seeing. And when you look at his, you know, I mean, I'm sorry that I have to do this, but it's, again, it's my job. I go to his social media platform and see what he posts. And it's just as crazy just Donald Trump crazy, the same old crazy we've been seeing for years, but there's a new layer to it. He's retweeting all these memes, all this weird stuff, all this way out there stuff. Now, is it, you know, is it his strategy? Maybe. I mean, is he that savvy that he's going, yeah, I got to keep these QAnon people on board? Or is it starting to, you know, is he starting to kind of think that way? I actually think that's an open question to me, whether or not he's actually going down that rabbit hole too. So that is terrifying. You know, the whole Republican Party follows that guy. God only knows why, but that may be where it's going. And that's really, really even scarier.
Well, there is one hope, obviously, and that is next week, midterms. Maybe enough Democrats, moderates, independents, whatever, can get out there and push back against the MAGA people. And look, we have seen polls all over the place in the last month. We have seen polls saying, nope, Republicans back in the lead. Nope, Democrats back in the lead. Oh, Fetterman's up by 8. Oh, now Oz is up by 2. I mean, look, we want to think we can trust all these polls. We want to think we know what's going to happen. But, you know, switching gears to the midterms here, we have no clue, right? I mean, I think we're going into this year's midterms more blind than really at any other time, because everything is so scattered with the polling data and with, you know, surveys. And I don't know. I mean, a lot of people say, what do you think is going to happen? I'm like, I don't know. I don't know. I wish I did. I wish I had an answer. But I don't know. I still feel optimistic, which is weird. I'm usually not optimistic, but I still think there could be some Democratic victories. How about you?
Well, I agree with you. We don't know. I mean, we really don't know. And even if you look at some of the big poll aggregators, you know, Nate Silver at 538, those kind of guys, people in the New York Times, they don't know either. It's pretty obvious that the pollsters don't know either. It's very close. And I would just, you know, it's very close. I mean, in the aggregate and in all these individual races where it matters, there's a boatload of toss-up races in the House. Now, you know, I guess people going on what the historical analysis says you should is that in a midterm, you know, the party in power loses those seats in the toss-ups, maybe. But they don't know. And it's gone the other way. And the polling has gone the other way. I mean, a lot of people are talking about how, well, they're undercounting Republicans again. They won't reply and blah, blah, blah. That could be true. They did undercount them in 2018 and 2020. But, you know, in 2012, they undercounted Democrats. This happens. And in close races, all these this kind of analysis is really just guesswork. You know, it's all just guesswork. One, that is what we know. It's close. It's close in a ton of races. It's certainly very close in these Senate races that we're all watching, Nevada and Arizona and Pennsylvania, and, you know, all these ones. So, you know, my feeling on it, I can't say I feel optimistic, because I honestly don't know what to feel, because I've never had. What has happened is unusual in that the closeness in a midterm is a little bit different. This is not something we've ever experienced. Generally speaking, even when it's bad and you're going, you know, like 2010, for instance, nightmare midterm, you know, you're sitting there going, okay, well, I'm hopeful. I really hope we pull it off and get those votes out and maybe the young will show up, you know, whatever the usual thing is. But you kind of know. I really don't know this time. This is new. And you've got all these early votes that are coming in. It's a massive early vote, but way exceeding 2018. It's a presidential year level turnout so far in the early vote. What does it mean? I don't know. Maybe Republicans are voting in huge numbers, you know, and didn't before. I mean, that's possible too. So I'm with you. I don't know what to say about this, except that I just want to point out to Democrats who are watching this, just to get some perspective on what we're seeing here. If you'd have told any of us 6 months ago that this race would be so close that we don't have any idea who's going to win it, we would have said you were crazy. Because 6 months ago, the conventional wisdom across the board was that it was going to be a Democratic slaughter. It was a huge red tsunami. It was coming. All the fundamentals were against them. This is the way it always goes in the midterms. And Joe Biden's approval rating was in the dirt. And that means it can't possibly win, blah, blah, blah. So I'm just saying, keep some perspective on where we were 6 months ago and where we are now, and think about what that tells you, win or lose. What that tells you is that there is a group of people, I mean, whatever happens, that doesn't look like the Democrats are going to get slaughtered. Let's just put it that way. It'll be a surprise. They may win, they may lose a ton of seats, but it won't be because of a no turnout or lack of, you know, they'll be close races. I mean, I think that much we can say is for sure. But just think about what that means, because what it means is that Democrats are seeing what's going on out here. They are not being complacent. Maybe they can't get it over the line. It's possible. There's an awful lot of headwinds. This inflation is killing everybody. It's, you know, there's still the hangover from the pandemic. People are suffering from mass PTSD from Trump and the pandemic and everything. You know, our culture, our society is in turmoil. Let's just put it that way. So, you know, what that means is that, you know, we are in a period that is kind of unpredictable. And if the Democrats do come out in large numbers and at least make the fight in this 2022 election, that gives me hope. Win or lose, it gives me hope, because it means that, you know, there's still a group of people out here who see what's going on and who are now. It's terrifying because of the consequences of the Republicans taking over, and we knew that. So, you know, I'm still hoping that they don't have a rout, and that a lot, especially these election deniers, if they can at least be defeated, these secretaries of state. And I read something this morning that indicates that there is some reason to believe they're not doing as well as Republicans in other offices, you know, these secretaries of state and stuff. So, you know, God willing, at least they, you know, you keep those people out. And then, of course, you know, as we were talking about before the show, you know, the 2024 election is on starting Wednesday morning. So, you know, then we have that to look forward to. But honestly, I think that we have to take some heart in it, that the Democrats are not, at least so far from everything we can gather, are not just sort of lying down and saying, you know, well, whatever, it's over, or just doing the old, you know, it's not a presidential year, it doesn't matter what happens. You know, they're paying attention, and they're actually, you know, there's some fight in them. So I'm happy to see that.
And, you know, you're talking about 6 months ago. See, about 6-7 months ago, I think it was Jim Jordan who came out with the Republican House members' projections. Uh-huh. They expected at the time they were going to pick up 70 to 80 seats is what they said. Mm-hmm. 70 to 80. And at the time, honestly, it was like, OK, that's that sounds about right.
And now, I thought it was possible. I really did. I mean, I thought it was totally possible.
Yeah. And now, I mean, well, polling a month ago said, yeah, Republicans still look like they're going to take it, but maybe only by 5 or 6 or 7 seats. I mean, mm-hmm. Dropping their chances down to 10% of what their projection was, that's a victory, right? We may not control the House, but them not, you know, having 90% of the seats they thought they were going to win, having them not pick those up, I'm going to count that in the win column, because a 70 seat Republican majority in that House, that's catastrophic. That is absolutely doing some things that are going to change the shape of this country. But a lot of
that's
it
a
too.
Mandate.
Oh, yeah, it is. And a lot of it, too, like you said, it's not just the House. It's not just the Senate. We've got these governors out here. Mm-hmm. You got, and I hate to say this, but I'm being real. We all know Ron DeSantis here in Florida, he's going to get reelected. And it's going to be a pretty, pretty big sweep for him. He's about 11 points up in the polls. He has never trailed. It's in the bag, unfortunately. But Arizona, right, that hotbed. Carrie Lake, doing much better than anybody thought she would, which is terrifying. Blake Masters now kind of coming up from behind a little bit. We could lose a lot in Arizona. Mm-hmm. And like you said, this puts election deniers in a position to where the next time they feel like it, not even with any evidence, just if they feel like it, you're going to have the people that Trump wants in place to say, know what, these electors, these are fake. We're going to give you some Trump electors. We're going to give you DeSantis electors. We'll give you whatever you want. We're just going to get rid of these Democrats because, you know, I don't think they actually won. That's the real threat in this year's midterms.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And in fact, I really think their new slogan that maybe we'll even see it on bumper stickers, I don't know, is the only way they can win is to cheat. That's what they're saying. And that's what they're indoctrinating their voters into believing, that it's literally impossible for Democrats to legitimately win. They can't do it. Every election they win is a cheat. Now, of course, it's totally illogical because on all the same ballots, you have Republicans winning at the same time. But, you know, this is the right we're talking about, and logic isn't really necessary to make an argument. But that's what I keep hearing now. And I think Carrie Lake said it just the other day, said, you know, the only way they can win is to cheat. And Donald Trump said it in 2022. He said it more than once during the campaign. So, you know, yes, that danger is, I mean, it's right upon us. I mean, I think that's why Biden made the speech this week that he made, the threat to democracy. You know, it's, that wasn't designed to move the electorate. That was designed to lay a, you know, to just lay out an argument that's very important for people to understand and to just have a marker there that, you know, I said this when I said it. This is what I said and I meant it. And somewhere down the road, maybe 50 years from now, they'll look back at that speech and go, well, you know, he said it, you know, he saw it coming. And it's important to say these things. You know, I mean, I really disagree with this idea that it's, you know, don't say anything about the threat to democracy and don't do that. You know, really just talk about the kitchen table issues. I mean, you have to talk about those things. I agree. But you cannot not talk about this threat to democracy. You just can't. Right. I mean, as I was saying earlier, you know, they're attacking the Speaker of the House and hitting her husband over the head with a hammer because of this. You know, this is what's happening. So you cannot ignore this stuff. I think that would be an absolute political malpractice for the people not to say. And I think it's a good thing for the president himself to say, because he speaks to the whole country. I mean, he's the president of all of us. You know, not that they admit it, but he is. And it's important for him to say these things. But yeah, we're facing a very, very, very difficult time. And, you know, I'm hopeful that next week we're going to see, you know, that the Democrats fought back. And that maybe they even won. It's not out of the realm of possibility. It really isn't. In fact, everybody should go read. There's a piece in 538 this week about, or I think it came out on Thursday, about him, about, you know, the scenario that is absolutely clear with all these toss-up state, all these toss-up races in both the House and the Senate, just how easily it could go either way and how it could be a real sweep. I mean, if there's entirely possible Democrats could win 54 seats in the Senate. I mean, nobody's expecting that, but, you know, why not? That's the races are razor thin. I mean, anything can happen. And by the way, polling in midterms is always, you know, nobody knows what's going on with that. So people shouldn't lose hope. And hopefully we'll all spend the weekend. I know we're going to be biting our nails, you know, just waiting, just trying to get through it and waiting to see what happens, because this really is a monumentally important election. But hopefully, you know, it will not be terrible. In 1998, I'll just point out, they all thought that, you know, they had the impeachment of Bill Clinton going, and Newt Gingrich was out there saying, we're going to take 40, 50 seats in the House, hands down, not a problem. They ended up winning 6. And that was widely considered to be, they didn't lose the control of the House, but it was widely considered and still is. It was considered at the time. I was there, I watched it, and I know what people said and thought at the time and what they think now. It was a loss for Republicans. They didn't lose the House, but they lost the prediction. And it changed everything for them. You know, the whole thing, the impeachment and everything, went a completely different direction because of it.
It did. And it's also worth pointing out, Bill Clinton's approval rating actually went up after that impeachment. So that was the biggest backfire I think Republicans could have ever done. And, you know, we talk about polling here. There's one thing I want to bring up. It's definitely depressing to bring up, but it is something that we have to think about, because this is not actually factored into the polling. We have had more than 1 million Americans die in the last 2 years from COVID. The studies, I mean, multiple different studies have confirmed as well, more Republicans died than Democrats. And I only bring that up to talk about how polling is done, so everybody understands this. Polling is based on census data. And the census was done in 2020 before 1 million people died. So when these pollsters go out and they say, we have to get a representative sample. Well, the census told us this area is 60-40 Republican-Democrat. So we talked to 60 Republicans for every 40 Democrats to get an even spread of what it looks like. Mm-hmm. Those numbers are not accurate anymore. They're not accurate for two reasons. One is the COVID death. Second, new data came out this week from Redfin, the real estate group, that showed that more minorities who typically vote Democrat have moved into traditionally white population red areas in swing districts. Redfin put that data out this week. It was phenomenal. So there's a lot of things that have shifted demographics since that census was taken. So I think a lot of the polling data, to a degree, is off. Redfin says they know that these changes in demographics in these areas have shifted the political affiliations in those swing districts by 1%. Not a huge shift, but 1% can absolutely change the outcome of an election, and that is not reflected in the polling. So we could see some surprises. I think it'll be more surprises, not necessarily for House races, probably for Senate, though, when you have a state that lost, 40,000 Republicans and only 10,000 Democrats to COVID. That's a swing. That's a swing in an election. And I don't want to say, yay, let's hope it happens, because it's morbid. But those are things that we have to be prepared for, because Republicans are going to say, oh, it's proof they stole it. We were polling ahead, but now we lost. So be prepared, because there's those little X factors out there, and Republicans will use it to try to claim fraud.
Yes. And of course, that's the big thing here that's happening, is that you get ready, because they're already saying it and the vote hasn't counted yet. That, well, the polls had us ahead. And, you can look at the mainstream media. It's been kind of, pumping this too. Well, the Republicans, the Democrats are on the run and the Republicans are ahead and blah, blah, blah. So if it doesn't happen, guaranteed, they're going to say that it was, due to fraud. And everybody needs to just gird themselves. This is going to happen going forward, at least through till the end of the Trump era, whenever, God help us, that might be. That this notion that they can't lose elections is going to be with them. And they're going to use that as a way to delegitimize, even if they lose, even if they're forced to accept the results of the election, they use that to delegitimize the Democrats. They're doing, as they're doing to Joe Biden right now. So everybody needs to get prepared for that. I think it's so interesting what you just said about the demographics, because I have not heard that and I haven't thought about that. But that is a fascinating, that's 1 million people. That's a lot of people throughout the country. And by the way, they're Republicans. Many of them were older, and those tend to be people who vote. Older people vote. And many of the people who unfortunately passed away from the pandemic were older people, not all, but, the majority. So that's a very interesting thought. And, I haven't heard any of the pollsters actually bring that up, or there's been a lot of talk about waiting and have we undercounted Republicans and all this stuff. There's been a ton of talk about it this time, to the point where, my eyes are glazing over with the discussion. But I haven't heard this brought up at all, or the Redfin thing, about the sort of movement since 2020. The cataclysm of the pandemic has had ripple effects on everything in our lives, everything. From all the stuff we've heard about schools to the economy, this is not surprising that there would be a huge, and by huge, I don't mean it's exactly what you say, 1% here or one little bit. This is a close election. And so we just don't know. And maybe it could go the other way. I mean, maybe there are places where, you'd expect a Democrat to pull it off, but there's been some kind of a shift there as a result of the pandemic. That will shift it into Republican hands in close places. I mean, I'm thinking about here in California, there's some races that are very close in like Orange County and, the wonderful Katie Porter, apparently she's really neck and neck in her race.
Yeah, I saw that story and I think my heart dropped, because by God, Katie Porter, folks, I don't care what we got to do. You got to protect Katie Porter.
Yeah,
oh, my God. I feel like she is the future of – I want her to be the future of the Democratic Party.
Yeah,
so please do not let Katie Porter lose. We need her voice probably more than anybody's.
Well, she's in Orange County, so that has always been – that was – in fact, it was shocking that she won there, because it's always been one of the conservative – it's Reagan country, right? I mean, that's what it was. But it's slowly been changing from demographics. So who knows? It could go the other way, because the demographics in her district are not what they used to be. And maybe they aren't what they used to be still. And maybe there's more people moving. I mean, we don't know. So that's very interesting that you point that out. That's something I'll definitely keep an eye on, because I think that is a fascinating insight, because I'm a believer that the pandemic was a cataclysmic event that we don't yet know in any way what the final consequences of that horrible thing were. And we're living through it now. And I blame it for a lot of the turmoil that we're feeling in our society, the emotions, the, you know, even the sense of violence. A lot of that is just coming out of this awful situation that was, by the way, just terribly mishandled by the Trump administration, which, of course, made it even worse because it divided people instead of bringing, you know, those kind of things tend to usually bring a people together. You know, look, we're fighting this force, you know, that we've got to pull together and all, you know, go in the same direction. And instead of that, he divided the country even more than it already was. And we're suffering the consequences of that. And you know, it'll be very interesting to see whether or not your insight will prove. And hopefully they will go back and look at that, you know, at the end of the day and see what that was.
Yeah, it is amazing just to see how many things have changed in these two short years. And again, they didn't have to change. Had Trump taken this seriously from day one and said, listen, left, right, I don't care what you are. At the end of the day, we're all human beings.
Yeah.
We're fighting this invisible menace, and we're going to do it together, by God. We're going to take care of each other. One speech in the beginning saying those things. Well, he'd be president right now.
I know.
That's horrifying to think about. So.
Horrifying, but still, it would have been better country. Would have been better for millions of people who wouldn't have died.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, or gotten very, very sick and had their lives upturned, and all the orphans that are left out there and all the families that were totally decimated by that thing. A lot of people died. Hundreds of thousands of people died because they listened to Donald Trump and didn't do what they should have done. And the anti-vax thing and all of that. So, you know, yeah. I mean, if he'd have done that, it would have been a whole different story for us right now, in good, both good and bad ways.
All right. So I've got a bit of a fun question for you here. Let's assume you got a magic wand. You can make any three candidates for any race in this country, any three, you can make them lose next week.
Oh.
which three?
Only three? I've got a whole book binder full of ones I'd like to see lose. That's not actually too hard for me to figure out. I would like to see, I mean, and you know, these are not ones that are necessarily going to lose, right? I mean, just ones that I'd like to see lose. You know, obviously I'd pick Marjorie Taylor Greene. If I could get rid of her, it would be fun. I would also pick Blake Masters. I think he is a real menace. I think he is a dangerous, dangerous person. I, you know, absolutely would not like to see him win, and I really, really hope he doesn't. And the other one I think I would pick is probably J.D. Vance, who I think is competing with Ted Cruz for most unctuous, unpleasant, you know, really, you know, gross politician, and we just don't need another one of those. You know, I mean, he's really awful. So those three, I think, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene is not going to lose. She's, you know, she's in, they love her there. But yeah, I mean, and also, you know, I mean, let's say, you know, Herschel Walker too. He has no business being anywhere near the Senate. It's an insult to the Senate that they actually put that guy up, and, you know, and he might win, which is.
Yeah. I don't even know what to do in that situation. If we have Senator Herschel Walker, that phrase, if we have anybody listening in Georgia, please make it to where we never have to say that phrase ever in our life. Senator Herschel Walker. That's the stuff of nightmares.
Yeah, it will pain me to have to write that. If I have to write Senator Herschel Walker, I mean, I can't even stand it. You know, it's so ridiculous. I mean, it really is. It's painful. And I can't believe that many Georgians are going to do it, especially when they have, you know, Raphael Warnock is a wonderful senator. And he is not some left-wing firebrand, you know, who's trying to, you know, go out there and turn the country woke or whatever these people think. He's really been very focused on Georgia. He's a great speaker. He is a real, I mean, who wouldn't want a senator like that? I just don't understand it. And to choose this other guy instead of him, choose Herschel Walker over Warnock. I think that's the insult makes it so much worse, is that they have such a good choice and they're actually picking, you know, they're picking that guy. And you know they hate him too. You know they do. Yeah. You know, most of those Georgians, they're just doing it to own the libs. They don't like Herschel Walker either. They know it's ridiculous.
Yeah, he's somebody that they'll end up primarying him if he wins 6 years from now and put him up with somebody, you know, that they find acceptable.
Exactly.
But you know, my God. Listen, Heather, I hope you'll come back with us next week. Because next week, obviously, we're going to have to talk about all the horrible things and hopefully some of the good things that happen on Tuesday. Yeah. But again, your analysis on everything, I could pose a question to you right now, probably about anything having to do with politics, and you would give me the most informed answer I've ever heard.
Oh,
so
thank you. That's nice.
It's always such a pleasure talking to you. Again, I do want you back next week.
I'm here. I'll be there. We're going to have something to talk about. You know that.
Yeah, one way or another, we absolutely will. So Heather Digby Parton, Salon.com. Thank you so much for talking with me.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And that's it for the free portion of this week's show. But remember, if you sign up and become a member, you get the full show every single week, plus access to the entirety of the Ring of Fire podcast archive. Go sign up at ROFpodcast.com.